Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. Dawood Bey, born in 1953, has portrayed Americans from marginalized groups with remarkable sensitivity and complexity throughout his 40-year career. When he was 11, Bey was shocked to see a picture of a young survivor of the 1963 Ku Klux Klan bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, Alabama. Four young black girls died in the church, and two African-American boys were murdered in related violence later that day. Decades later, for the Birmingham Project, Bey created 16 pairs of life-size portraits of present-day residents of Birmingham, one of a young person the same age as a victim in 1963, and another of an adult 50 years older, the child's age had she or he survived. Representing these unwitting icons of the civil rights movement with ordinary people, the diptychs connect generations and, as Bey explained, make the children real, tangible. These girls are an abstraction to people, the mythic four girls. We lose sight of their humanity. On December 16, 2018, as part of the Arnold Newman Lecture Series on Photography at the National Gallery of Art, Bey discusses his artistic practice and celebrates the publication of his monograph, Seeing Deeply. His work is represented in the gallery's collection by four inkjet print diptychs and the video 9/15/63, which are on view in the exhibition Dawood Bey, The Birmingham Project, through March 24, 2019.
I'm going to share with you this afternoon a few related projects, two pairs of projects that give you some sense of my beginnings as well as work that I'm currently in the midst of. My work begins, auspiciously enough, in 1969 with the exhibition Harlem on My Mind at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York. And for those of you old enough to remember 1968, 1969 was a moment of profound social upheaval in this country, not only in this country, but elsewhere. That upheaval extended itself to museums. This idea that people began to speak back to institutions in power extended to the museum world as well. And one of those cultural flashpoint moments happened in 1969 with the opening of this exhibition at the Met. Without going too deeply into the history of this exhibition, Harlem in My Mind was an exhibition about Harlem from the turn of the century up until 1968. And when the exhibition opened, and even prior to the exhibition opening, there were several issues that arose. One of those issues had to do with the fact that there were those in the African American community in New York who felt that while this was an exhibition about Harlem, which was, of course, by that time, an African-American community primarily, there had been very little input from the community around the construct of this exhibition that was presumably about them. So that was one piece of the controversy around this exhibition. The other piece of the controversy had to do with an essay that appeared in the exhibition publication that had been written by a young high school student by the name of Candace Van Ellison. And that essay which had in some significant ways been distorted by removing quotation marks from some of the remarks in the essay so that they ended up appearing to be her remarks that were taking issue with what some people saw as the exploitative relationship between some of the Jewish merchants in Harlem and the African American community. That essay got the attention of Mayor Kahane, and Mayor Kahane formed the Jewish Defense League at that moment, and they were protesting this exhibition as well. So all of that controversy found its way into the media and talk radio. And at the age of 16, I heard about this controversy, and more so than going to see the exhibition, I wanted to go see the controversy. I was very politically and socially engaged even by that time, because in 1968, you know, the saying in 1968 was that you're either part of the solution or you're part of the problem. That was a very popular saying then. So I was very politically and socially engaged, and I wanted to go see what this controversy was about. So I went to the Metropolitan Museum, I think, to see the demonstrations. And as it turns out, on the day I went, there were no demonstrations. And I often think about that moment as fate conspiring that the demonstrators not be there so that I could go into the museum and see the exhibition. Because quite frankly, if there had been a picket line, I don't know that I would have crossed the picket line to go in and see the exhibition. But since there were no demonstrators, I ventured into the museum for what turned out to be my first visit to a museum on my own ever. I was completely intimidated about being in the space. I had no idea where the exhibition was. I didn't have the wherewithal to ask anyone at the information desk where the exhibition was, because I somehow felt like I was supposed to know. You know, I've often described that moment as seeing people walking around who looked like they knew where they were going. So I thought I should know where I was going. So I just walked around pretending that I knew where I was going, looking for this exhibition. And ultimately, I found the exhibition. And it became a hugely significant moment. I had just gotten my first camera from my godmother the year before, a camera that had belonged to my godfather. And I wasn't interested at all in photography, as far as I remember. But after we went to my godmother's house, after the wake for my godfather, she invited me upstairs before we left and said, I have something I want to give you. And she opened up the top drawer and the dresser drawer and handed me a camera. And she said, this camera used to belong to your godfather, and I think you should have it. I politely took the camera with no idea what I might do with it. And seeing this exhibition, Harlem on My Mind, coupled to my own family's history, began to give me some sense of what I might do with this camera. The exhibition was my first encounter with the work of James Van Der Zee, whose photographs were included in the exhibition. Some of you might know Van Der Zee was an African-American studio photographer working in Harlem in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s. His work had been discovered by a photo researcher working with the curator of Harlem on My Mind, a man by the name of Reginald McGee. And Reginald McGee found Van Der Zee, found his work, and included him in this exhibition. So just the experience of seeing these formal, informal portraits of everyday African-Americans in a museum context began to give me some sense of what I might think about doing with this camera. Along with James Van Der Zee's work, around that same time, I don't even remember how I got a copy of it, but I got a copy of Roy de Caraba and Langston Hughes' book, The Sweet Flypaper of Life, which again began to shape my thinking about photography and the black subject, photography and subjects that were like the people that I had come to know in my own community and my own family. The fact that these two things could come together in some meaningful kind of way. So after my encounter with the Sweet Flypaper of Life, and looking at De Caraba's photographs, one of the things that I began to think about, of course, was, you know, James Van Der Zee had been a studio photographer who made photographs of people who came to the studio. In a way, self-authored their photographs and their likeness in collaboration with James Van Der Zee. But Van Der Zee's work was entirely dependent on those subjects coming to him. On the other hand, Roy de Caraba is working independently as an artist, going out into the world and trying to craft an idiosyncratic aesthetic and visual language to everyday African-American subjects in Harlem. So Van Der Zee and then de Caraba came another piece of my evolving self-education project. Gordon Parks was another photographer who came on my radar at that time through his work that appeared in Life magazine. And then I started going out, seeking out photography exhibitions. I found out about these exhibitions because, fortunately for me, my father bought the Sunday Times newspaper. And back then, in the Sunday Times art section, there was an extensive listing of exhibitions. And all the way down at the bottom of those listings was something called photography. And it was always only maybe one, two, maybe three exhibitions devoted to photography that were listed. But that's where I began to get a sense of what photography exhibitions were up. And then I would just go look as a process of my own self-education. And one of the photographers that I encountered that way was Mike List Farmer, a photographer working in Herbert Springs, Arkansas, the Museum of Modern Art, around 1976-77, had mounted a small exhibition of Disc Farmer's work. So I went to see Mike Disc Farmer. None of these names or photographs were known to me before I encountered them in these exhibitions. Around that same time, the big Avedon show opened at Marlborough Gallery in New York. And so I went to see the Avedon show. And I was looking at a lot of other exhibitions also, because I remember going to see an exhibition at the Met by Harry Callahan. And as much as I loved that work, it never occurred to me that I might want to make, I don't know, poetic photographs of reeds of grass in the snow. No, I loved the work, but I was beginning to, in looking at this work, get a sense of what my own subject matter might be. I was simultaneously educating myself as to the history of the medium, but also I was in search of what my own subject matter was going to become. And so I started seeking out different photographers. August Sander, who photographed the German population before the beginning of World War II, spent a lot of time looking at Walker Evans, as well as some of the other Farm Security Administration photographers. And I was also looking at artists like Charles White. Charles White, who having spent a good deal of time working in Chicago, later went on to teach in LA at what became the Otis Art Institute. But I started to see Charles White's work in Ebony Magazine, where it was reproduced. And Charles White made these beautifully crafted drawings that gave these ordinary African Americans a kind of epic and iconic presence. So Charles White became a part of my point of reference, along with Romare Bearden, who, in addition to the work that he made about the time that he was in Harlem, also made work that recalled his early growing up and his continued relationship with the people in Mecklenburg, South Carolina. And Emory Douglas, who was the Minister of Information for the Black Panther Party, which I had joined when I was probably 14 or 15 years old. And Emory Douglas was making drawings, illustrations that appeared regularly in the Black Panther Party newspaper that also gave a very heightened sense of presence to ordinary African Americans. And so with the experience of looking at a lot of that work and taking into consideration my own family's history, which begins in a way, my history anyway, begins in Harlem with my mother and father meeting in Harlem. This is a photograph that my father made, actually, of my mother and my Aunt Louise when they were living in Harlem on 151st Street. But the experience of looking at all of that work and thinking back on the experience of the Harlem On My Mind exhibition led me to my first project, making my own photographs in Harlem from 1975 to 1979, which ultimately became a project that I called Harlem USA. And I more or less began to learn how to shape ideas about the subject into resonant photographs by going out into the streets of Harlem regularly to make the work that you see here. And certainly, in addition to my family's history in Harlem and the Harlem On My Mind exhibition, I was also very interested in adding something to the very long conversation about Harlem as a significant site of African American social and cultural articulation. I wanted to contribute something in my time to the conversation around how Harlem was imagined and visualized. And so from 1975 to 1979, I made these photographs in Harlem. One of the things that I quickly found out as I began making this work, the photograph of the man in the bowler is the photograph that I call the first photograph that I made that actually looks like the things I imagined making. And what I found out from making this photograph, that there's the idea of the photograph, and then there's the reality of creating and making the work inside of a very particular set of social circumstances. You know, this man, along with, if I remember rightly, there were three older men having a conversation one Sunday morning. I saw them as I came into the block, and I particularly saw this man and knew that I wanted to make a photograph of him. I was probably about 19 years old, maybe 20. And I knew I wanted to make a photograph of him, but he was talking to three of his friends. And it was pretty clear to me that in order to photograph him, I was going to have to interrupt the conversation that these four older men were having, which was something I don't think I was quite prepared to do. But I saw him, and as I approached the group, actually, I pretty much lost my nerve. I didn't know how to do this thing of inserting myself into this social situation in order to ask if I can make a photograph of you. Not the other three, just you. I didn't know how to do this. And so I just nodded good morning and kept walking. And that was the moment that I realized that if I couldn't figure this out, I was not going to be able to do and be this thing that I imagined myself being and the photograph that I imagined making. So I turned around, and obviously voices are going off in my head. What are they gonna say? They just saw you. How are they gonna feel about you coming back, approaching them again? You just passed by this way, now you're coming another way. But I quieted all of those voices in my head as I approached them and simply focused my attention on him and asked him if I could make a photograph of him. And he said, yes. And then he said, what do you want me to do? So now I figured out the social thing. Now there's the picture making thing. And that's when I began to realize what making the work was actually going to require. An inserting of myself in some kind of way into people's lives momentarily, and then trying to figure out how to shape that into something that resonated as a photograph. Because clearly the photograph and the experience, they're related things, but they're not the same thing. The photograph has to work on its own terms. So this is the photograph on which I first figured it out. The next photograph here of the young woman standing in the doorway presented an entirely different set of challenges because I saw her from across the street and I knew I wanted to photograph her, but I never photographed with long lenses. I always photographed with relatively short lenses. Actually, I don't want to get all techie, but 35 millimeter lenses, not even 28, but short enough that to make the kind of intimate photograph of people that I wanted to make, you have to have some physical proximity to them. You can't do it from across the street. You have to engage, and that engagement turns into the photograph. So I crossed the street and asked her if I could make a photograph of her, and of course the whole thing changed. She put her arms down and we started talking. And then she said again that question, what do you want me to do? And it occurred to me that what I wanted her to do was what I had already seen. But then it also occurred to me that I could recreate the thing that I had seen, which for me was a huge conceptual leap. So I said, well, why don't you do what you were doing before I walked up to you? And she said, okay, fine. And she did. That gave me a very significant sense that the photographs come out of a very particular kind of process, and that process is as much about creating a momentary relationship as it is about then directing the subject in some kind of credible way back to their own behaviors so that the photograph has some credibility or resonance, perhaps. So I spent from 1975 to 1979 working on these photographs in the streets of Harlem. And when I was almost when I felt like finished with this work, when I felt like it was getting to the point that I had said what I wanted to say, about the subject and about the community in terms of making a representation that spoke to who I felt this community was, a community that had been represented visually through a lens of pathology, the way the Black urban community often represented. And I wanted to make a more honest representation of the Harlem community. And as I completed this work and thought about where I might want to exhibit these photographs, I thought back to the Harlem on My Mind exhibition, because one of the other bones of contention about that exhibition was the fact that the photographs had been made in and about Harlem, but they were shown outside of that community. And for that reason, I decided that I wanted the work to be shown and seen in the community in which the photographs had been made. And so I approached the Studio Museum in Harlem about having an exhibition of the completed works, which is where in 1979 I had the first exhibition of my Harlem, USA photograph. But it's very important to me that the people who were the subjects of the work have access to that work, that one could conflate the subject and the audience into a single entity. Almost 40 years later, I returned to Harlem, which was at that point in yet another cycle of change. And those changes had to do largely with what we would call gentrification and the way that the influx of global capital begins to reshape certain communities. And I wanted to make some work in Harlem about what this change and what this reshaping of the Harlem community looked like as it was taking place, not to photograph the aftermath of that, but to see if I could in some way insert myself into that change as it was taking place and figure out a way to describe and to talk about that, to craft a visual and conceptual language around the way in which the Harlem community was being reshaped. And so in 2014, I started this project that I worked on for several years, trying to talk about, piece by piece, photograph by photograph, the way in which this community was both being reshaped around people who already lived there, as well as the way in which that community was being reshaped for a new population that was moving in. And this work became, for me, the first extended project that I did that was not significantly related to the human subject as the primary subject of the photograph or portraits. It was one of my first projects in which I wanted to take on the challenge of describing the space around the subject rather than making the subject the human presence. It took me about a year and a half of persistent photographing to craft a language that I felt described some of the things that were going on in this community. Things like this photograph, I had seen this park before. It had been a small public park, and I walked by one day, and now it has steel gates on it and two padlocks. The idea of the way in which public space was becoming increasingly privatized. This privatization of once public space, that was one of the things that was happening in the community, as well as the way the shape was being both physically and socially reshaped for a very new and changing demographic. One of the things that's been happening in Harlem for the past several years is something that this photograph alludes to, which is the influx of tourism in the community. And in this case, there's an influx of tourists in the churches in Harlem on Sunday. And I was trying to figure out, how does one make a photograph about this? Because I always, in the work that I make, want to make photographs that in some way engage the idea of a kind of visual poetic. Photographs that evocatively or resonant allude to a set of circumstances. So this is a group of tourists who are actually lined up to attend church service at one of the most prominent churches in Harlem, Abyssinian Baptist Church. And even as I've continued this project, one of the things that I have wanted to do, in addition to describing the way in which this newly evolving space is wrapping itself around people in the community, is to describe what that looks like from inside that situation, which is what this photograph here describes. The other thing that's happening in Harlem, as the neighborhood continues to evolve, is this shifting and changing sense of place memory as places that are significant social and cultural landmarks in the community begin to disappear, such as the Lenox Lounge, which I have photographed over several years. Here, it had been shuttered for a number of years until eventually, recently, it was torn down. What's coming up on this site of the Lenox Lounge, which had been the site of performances by a wealth of well-known jazz musicians, it's being replaced by, of course, a Sephora Cosmetics Emporium. So the way that there's this loss of cultural memory, displacement of place memory for people who have been in the community, even as people who are newly arrived to the community have no sense of that history at all. And this is yet another tour bus going by in Harlem in front of what was, at the time, a newly constructed Whole Foods was built that displaced a whole block of small businesses in Harlem. And there's this landscape of constant construction. And how does one describe this construction and transformation that is enveloping a community? This is actually the construction sign where that new Starbucks is being built, where someone has graffitied in bright red paint the word lust. And this is probably, I think, the last photograph that I made in this project. And what it describes is the new building of the Columbia University campus, on the west side of Harlem from 125th Street up to about 132nd Street. And Columbia University declared eminent domain over that whole piece of Harlem. And there were homes and businesses that were seized in order for the university to enact what has been the single largest expansion of the university since its creation in 1837 in the West Harlem community. So along with the Harlem Redux photograph, just before I started that project, I was working on the Birmingham Project. And the Birmingham Project begins with a visit that James Baldwin made to the church that I grew up in New York. And Baldwin came to speak at the church, and afterwards there was a reception, and at the reception, this book, the movement was being sold as a fundraising vehicle for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And it was a book of photographs of and about the Civil Rights Movement. And the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee had gathered the photographs and given them to the writer and playwright, Lorraine Hansberry, asking her if she could write a text that would weave the photographs together in book form. And so my parents bought this book, and they brought it home. And there were a lot of horrific photographs in this book, including this photograph, which for whatever reason was the photograph that resonated most strongly with me looking through the book. And the thing that I only came to understand later that I hadn't intuited when I first saw this photograph was that I was pretty much the same age as the girl in the picture, which very well may be why the photograph resonated so strongly with me. But this photograph, I think you can say I could mark my life before this photograph and my life after this photograph, because this photograph just seared itself into my psyche. And one day, I would say some 40 years after that moment, I awoke in a start one morning, and this picture came flashing back. Something had dislodged it from wherever I had put it. Now, I kind of parked this picture somewhere. And one morning, it literally felt like someone had slapped me on the back of the head. You know, I used that expression to sit bolt upright in bed. But up to that point, I thought it was just an expression. But I sat bolt upright in bed, and this picture came flashing back. And I decided I needed to do something with that. At the very least, I decided I needed to go to Birmingham. I had never been to Birmingham before, but I decided, just based on how strongly this picture came flooding back, that I needed to go and see the place where this had happened. As most of you probably know, that the girl laying in the bed, wounded, Sarah Jean Collins, is the older sister of Addie Mae Collins, who was one of the four girls who was killed in the dynamiting of the 16th Street Baptist Church on September 15th, 1963. Four girls were killed, And Sarah Jean Collins, who survived because she was not standing as close to the wall on the opposite side of which the dynamite had been planted. The four girls were here. She might have been over here. So she didn't get the full force of the blast, but she did lose one eye and partial vision in the other. So I planned a visit to Birmingham for a weekend. I think I went Saturday, planning to stay Saturday and then go to a church service at the 16th Street Baptist Church, just so I could put myself in the place where this tragic history had taken place. And it was a very interesting initial visit because I had a conversation with the minister at 16th Street Baptist Church after the service, which gave me a sense of the difference between the mythic history that I was bringing and life as it was actually being lived in Birmingham at that time. Because when I mentioned to the minister that I was a photographer, an artist, thinking of coming to Birmingham to make some work, and he asked me, what would you like to make work about? I kind of thought it was self-evident, but I said, well, I'm thinking about making work about, you know, that moment, September 15th, 19. And before I could even finish getting the year up, he cut me off and he said, stop right there. He said, let me tell you something. He said, here at 16th Street Baptist Church, we're not about all that business. We're about the business of Jesus Christ. And if you want to make some work about that, we would love to work with you. And of course, I was taken aback. I think I did a fairly decent job of keeping a straight face. I didn't look surprised. But it just made me immediately realize that I was bringing something to this situation that I had been carrying around for 40 years. The minister had a whole other set of concerns that were not necessarily that. So it was a kind of abrupt wake-up call that I was in contemporary Birmingham, that I was bringing my sense of this history to this place. And so I started planning periodic visits to Birmingham after that to get a sense of the place, to begin to build community there, to begin to meet people in the community. And at some point, as I have done for almost all of the projects that I've done since 1993, I got in touch with the Birmingham Museum of Art and told them that I was interested in making some work there, had no idea what form that work might take, but asking them if they would be interested in partnering with me on this project when and if I could figure it out. That began an extended conversation with the museum, and it also began a series of extended visits to Birmingham over several years, just kind of taking visual, you know, photographic notes like this, taking note of the place, trying to get a sense of the place. And eventually, through an introduction, I started doing research at the Birmingham Civil Rights Institute through an introduction that someone I met through the Birmingham Museum of Art made. And I started spending time in the archive of the Birmingham Civil Rights Institute. And it was in doing research there that I began to get a deeper and more specific sense of the history. And I also came to know pieces of the history that I didn't know. Most significantly, that on the day that the four girls had been killed, two young African-American boys were killed that same day. I did not know that at all before I started spending time doing research. Most people outside of Alabama in the South don't know about the two boys. Most people in Alabama and Birmingham do. The two boys, Johnny Robinson and Virgil Ware, killed the same day in the violent aftermath of the dynamiting of the church, which turned out to be only the beginning of a very tragic day. After the dynamiting of the church, the White Citizens Council and the Ku Klux Klan held what could be called a pep rally at a high school football field. And after that pep rally, which was held to celebrate what had happened that morning, white citizens from Birmingham then ran out into the streets, celebrating and whooping it up, waving Confederate flags from their cars. And police said that they saw 16-year-old Johnny Robinson throwing rocks at one of those cars. And they called out to him, and instead of approaching the police officer, he turned around and started scooting away. And as he was going away, the police officer raised his shotgun and shot 16-year-old Johnny Robinson in the back, killing him there in the streets of downtown Birmingham. That same day, two brothers, the Ware brothers, had a newspaper route, and they had been delivering their Sunday papers a ways outside of downtown Birmingham. They may have been out in Collegeville. I don't exactly remember what part of Birmingham. But two white teenagers, left that pep rally pumped up. And one of them went home and got his little pistol out of the shoebox in the closet, stuck the pistol in his waistband. And then the two of them got on a little motor scooter, went to a hardware store, got two little Confederate flags, stuck the flags in the handlebars, and now they're riding around looking to contribute to the mayhem of the day. And they encounter, at some point, the two Ware brothers coming from the opposite direction, who didn't even know, as they were delivering their papers that morning, that the church had been dynamited. And as the two white teenagers got closer to the Ware brothers, one of them pulled a pistol out and took two shots at them and killed the younger brother, Virgil Ware, who fell off of the bicycle that he and his brother were riding, and died in his brother's arms shortly after. So once I knew about those two young African-American boys, I knew that I had to embrace them in the shape of whatever the project was that I was going to do. And what I decided to do was to make photographs of young African-Americans in Birmingham who were the ages that those six young African-Americans had been when they were killed. The girls were 11 and 14, and the boys were 13 and 16, which still left me feeling that the project needed something more than that, in terms of something to allude more deeply, not only to the passage of time, but to allude to the lives that those six young people had never been allowed to have, which is when I decided to make portraits of African-American adults who were the ages that they would have been, and to pair them in the form of diptychs so that each piece would, in fact, represent 50 years. Working with the Birmingham Museum of Art, we did extensive outreach using every available platform. I did a number of visits to schools, basically letting people know that I was working on this project and that I was seeking subjects of a very specific age, which made the outreach that much more daunting because I wasn't just looking to photograph young people and older people, but young people who were 11, 13, 14, and 16. Or, because the show was going to open the following year, I made some allowances that they could be a year younger at that time, but had to be that age by the time the show opened. Because for me, part of the resonance of the work is in describing what does an 11-year-old African-American girl look like. To take this mythic sense of the four girls and the two boys, and to give them a real palpable physical presence through these young people. And so I made these photographs in two different locations, one of which, as you can see in the photograph here, the first location was the Birmingham Museum of Art itself, to use the museum, which had, for the adults, at the time of the Civil Rights Movement, the Birmingham Museum, like all public institutions in the South, was a segregated institution. The adults, when they were younger, they could not visit the Birmingham Museum of Art until the museum relented and declared one day a week as Negro Day. And so I wanted to use that piece of Birmingham's segregated history, as well as the black communal space of the church, and to have those two pieces of history wrap themselves around the subject. So I spent several months having people one at a time come to sit for these portraits, which were later joined as diptychs. None of the people in these diptychs knew each other. They didn't come together. Some of them, they were all made at least hours, if not days or months apart. And I put them together after the fact, looking for some either physical, dispositional, or gestural relationship that would make them cohere as a single piece. All of the young people that I photographed for this project, when I went into the schools talking about that history, all of them were acutely aware of what had happened in 1963, long before any of them were born. And of course, because the adults 50 years earlier would have been the same ages as those young people, a number of them knew one or more of the girls who had been killed. So the work became an actual historical embodiment of that history, as much as it was a representation and a reimagining of that history, because the adults in these photographs actually carry and brought that history with them to be photographed. So being, again, mindful of the institutional space and the narrative of the institutional space, it was always the intention to exhibit these works in the Birmingham Museum of Art. And at some point, the director mentioned to me that the 50th year of this moment that I was making work about was approaching, and that we should, in fact, present this work in September 2013 to mark that 50th year. And so in September 2013, almost exactly 50 years to the date of the dynamiting of the 16th Street Baptist Church, the exhibition opened at the Birmingham Museum of Art. Now you can imagine for the adults who were not able to, when they were younger, legally enter the museum, you have to know that the last thing they would have imagined was seeing themselves on the wall of that same institution. And that's very much a part of what the project was about. You know, this way of making and creating a conversation between the institutional space of the museum and the larger community in which the institution is situated, to somehow make the inside of the institutional space either resemble more the outside world surrounding it, or to create through the work a conversation between the two. So the Birmingham project, which I probably spent 7 or 8 years between researching the initial interest and photographing and the opening, got me deeply engaged with history. I wanted to extend that with this work by making what became the second video work that I completed. That's a part of the exhibition here too, as Sarah mentioned, 915-63. These are just some production photographs of me working with the 6'3" production company. I interviewed a number of production companies in Birmingham and decided to work with these guys. But I have to say, it was absolutely wonderful to work with. It was like being in a band again. You know, filmmaking is very collaborative. You have to work with a group of people. I used to be a drummer, so for me, it felt like being in a band again. You know, working with these folks to make something. But as I said, working on this project got me deeply engaged with and thinking about history and how I might visualize or otherwise reimagine some aspect of African American history. How to visualize or think about history in the contemporary moment, how to make it resonate in the contemporary moment. 2 years ago, I began a conversation with Fred Bidwell in Cleveland, Ohio, who has an exhibition space called Transformer Center. And Fred was interested in knowing if I was interested in making some work there. And I told him I was only interested if I could continue this idea that I had of working with history. So I started doing some research, and my research uncovered the significant history in northern and northeastern Ohio in relation to the Underground Railroad. And so the Underground Railroad project that I began ultimately started with a conversation and then a commission from Front International, a new triennial exhibition project that opened in Cleveland over the summer. But the Underground Railroad, as some of you I'm sure know, was not an actual railroad, and it wasn't underground. It was, in fact, the movement through the landscape of fugitive slaves with the assistance of what came to be called various underground railroad stations as places that harbored them or gave harbor to them, along with those people who aided them in their movement through the landscape as they fled toward freedom in Canada, who became known as underground railroad conductors. And there's significant history in Cleveland and in Hudson, Ohio, given Ohio's proximity to Lake Erie, because 50 miles across Lake Erie is Canada, and fugitive slaves would make their way to Canada by way of Lake Erie. As I began to think about this idea of these black fugitive bodies moving through the darkness of night, or the black fugitive bodies moving through these black spaces, I started to think about Roy de Caravas' photographs. a number of his photographs, African-American subjects, printed very darkly, like these photographs. There's this wonderfully dark space that wraps itself around the subjects, and the subjects kind of move in and come out of that space. And Roy de Caraba's photograph became a kind of conceptual touchstone for me for the Underground Railroad-related work that I started to make, along with this line from Langston Hughes' poem, Dream Variation, and the final line of that poem, rested pale evening, a tall, slim tree, night coming tenderly, black like me. This notion that that blackness, that space of blackness, can be a tender embrace that Langston Hughes gives voice to in this poem became the starting point for the making of these Underground Railroad sites. Now, the sites are by and large not actual Underground Railroad sites. The Underground Railroad, the trajectory of which was never meant to be known. I mean, fugitive slaves are moving through the landscape secretly. So as it turns out, there's a lot of myth attached to the Underground Railroad as well, given that there's a lot of filling in of the blanks that has to be done in order to construct this history. So I was not interested in a literal reconstruction of Underground Railroad sites as much as I was trying to make an evocative visualization of the landscape in proximity to some of those sites or in proximity to some of those imagined sites. And so I began photographing in Cleveland, Ohio. And as it turns out, a lot of the material culture, a lot of the physical and material culture of the Underground Railroad in Cleveland has been largely built over. As things tend to get built over in cities, the few known Underground Railroad sites in Cleveland were built over initially by Case Western University and then later by the Cleveland hospital system. So there wasn't much to go on other than some sites that I was able to find through doing research online. And so what I began doing was photographing the landscape in proximity to those places, the landscape around those places, trying to make these photographs from the vantage point of what might it have both looked and felt like to be moving through these spaces at that moment under cover of darkness. The lack of a number of tangible sites in Cleveland led me to research the trajectory of the path through the landscape leading into Cleveland, which took me out to Hudson, Ohio, a much more rural area where a lot of the material culture of that history still survived, such as this photograph here, which is made not too far from where John Brown's house used to be in Hudson. There was a very large abolitionist community in Hudson, Ohio. And I was trying to, in the positionality, give a sense of what it might have taken to move through the landscape undetected, like staying close to a house in this photograph here. You know, this house actually happens to be one of the few historically designated Underground Railroad stations in Cleveland. And this is the former site of John Brown's tannery in Hudson. And again, it's the former site. We don't know that it was this house. We don't, you know, it's all based on research that I was able to do, to end up at a particular place and then to photograph the landscape around those places to try to give a sense of, an active sense of the landscape that fugitive slaves were moving through, including photographs that include water. Part of the narrative of escape has to do with fugitive slaves periodically entering bodies of water. And as you move through the water and then re-enter on land, you're not leaving your scent behind because your scent gets lost in the water. So I knew that as part of the larger narrative, I wanted to include different bodies of water within the landscape. This particular location happens to be in very close proximity to the house of John Brown's oldest son. It's actually a creek that I'm overlooking from just a few feet away from Owen Brown's house. It's actually called Owen Brown Street. And this is that farmhouse on Owen Brown Street. It's been alluded to that Owen Brown may have lived there. Again, it's not, you know, I'm trying to evoke the past without the challenge of engaging in a literal, factual retelling. I'm trying to make something that is resonantly evocative. Now, this photograph, I have to say, you know, this particular photograph, which is on a bluff overlooking Lake Erie, which would have been the end of that journey, and then from this point, 50 miles across to Canada. When I was setting up to make this particular photograph, I had an experience that I had not had in the year and a half that I had been making photographs. It was an experience that let me know that this probably was an actual site. Because as I was setting up to make this photograph, I inextricably felt the presence of hundreds of eyes watching me from both sides. And that was not anything I was looking to find. You know, I was not looking to have that kind of experience. I was thinking strictly in terms of, you know, how to make photographs that describe what might have been. But the feeling that I got for the time that I was standing at this site overlooking Lake Erie, which one would have had to have passed by in order to get to Lake Erie, gave me a profound sense that I was, in fact, standing at an actual, not imagined, location. And this is the final photograph in that project, which is Lake Erie. When that project was completed, I originally installed them in a church in Cleveland, St. John's Episcopal Church, which was an active Underground Railroad station. It was the final stop slaves made before continuing on to Lake Erie. That work is actually going to open next month in Chicago at the Art Institute, where I'll be having the first museum exhibition of that work. And since I started the Birmingham Project talking about James Baldwin, I thought it might be fitting to end with this quote by Baldwin. It says, "The great force of history comes from the fact that we carry it within us, are unconsciously controlled by it in many ways. And history is literally present in all that we do." Thank you.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.